Have you ever stopped to think about your internet connection? I mean, really think about how fundamental it's become. You know, for remote work, online school, streaming shows, just staying connected. It's basically the digital lifeblood of everything we do now. But what if the companies actually providing that connection, the ones we've relied on for years, what if they're the ones struggling to keep pace with all the changes? Okay,
Actually,
let's unpack this because today's deep dive is exactly about that. We're zooming in on the US internet service provider industry. Specifically, we're looking at the big traditional cable operators, you know, companies like Comcast and Charter Communications. And our mission for you today, it's to give you a shortcut, a way to quickly grasp all the complex stuff that's going on. We're talking technological shifts, fierce market battles, huge financial pressures, even big regulatory changes, all hitting at once and reshaping an industry that honestly was pretty stable, kind of a predictable duopoly for a long time. We'll explore what this massive shift means for their future, and maybe more importantly, what it could mean for your wallet and your own internet experience.
yeah, it's really fascinating. The core challenge for these big cable companies, you can almost picture it like a pincer movement. Imagine being squeezed from two sides at the same time.
Okay.
From one direction, you've got this relentless attack from premium fiber providers, super high speeds, top-tier service. And from the other side, you've got this really disruptive surge from 5G fixed wireless access. That's all about value, simplicity.
Wow. Okay. So pressure from both the high end and the low end.
Exactly. And if that wasn't enough, you've got these other deep-seated problems piling on, like the steady decline of traditional TV, the video side of the business. Plus, they're facing these incredibly tough decisions about where to invest billions, massive capital spending choices. And then there's the regulatory environment, which is just volatile, unpredictable. It's not just one challenge. It's like a perfect storm brewing.
So the US cable industry, for decades, it felt like they had it made, right? Almost an unchallenged duopoly in lots of places. Now it sounds like a multi-front war. Let's start with that premium end you mentioned. What's the biggest threat coming from that direction?
Well, what's really striking is just how aggressive and how well-funded the expansion of fiber to the home or FTTH has become. This isn't just another competitor popping up. It's a fundamental technological leap. It directly challenges cable's whole claim to having the best product.
How so? What makes fiber that much better?
It really comes down to a few key advantages that cable's older infrastructure, their hybrid fiber coax networks, or HFC, they just struggle to match. We're talking symmetrical multi-gigabit speeds.
Symmetrical, meaning upload is as fast as download.
Precisely. And that's becoming absolutely critical. Think about remote work, video calls all day long, or people uploading huge files, creative projects, cloud backups, even just family sharing tons of high-res photos and videos. That fast upload speed is a game changer. Fiber also generally offers lower latency, less delay, which is huge for gaming or real-time applications, and it's generally seen as more reliable than the older HFC networks. So these features aren't just nice extras anymore. They're becoming essential for those high-value customers, the power users, the gamers, and especially those work-from-home professionals who need that rock-solid, super-fast connection.
That makes total sense. So, who are the big players pushing this fiber revolution? And just how big are we talking? Is this nationwide?
The scale is, well, it's unprecedented, really. AT&T is a great example. They've really established themselves as a leader here. As of, say, mid-2025, they'd already run fiber past over 30 million homes and businesses.
30 million. Wow.
And they're not stopping. Their target is roughly 60 million total fiber locations by the end of 2030, basically doubling their footprint. And what's interesting is the pace is actually picking up. Some new legislation is helping them accelerate, aiming for an extra million locations per year starting around 2026.
How are they doing it? Just building it all themselves?
It's a mix. They're doing organic builds, yes, but also joint ventures like Gigapower and even strategic acquisitions like their planned purchase of Lumen's consumer fiber business. And it's paying off. They added 261,000 net fiber customers in Q1 2025, another 243,000 in Q2. That's serious growth. It's an aggressive land grab for the future, basically.
What about Verizon? Fios has been around for a while, right? Are they keeping pace?
You're right. Verizon built a strong Fios footprint, though maybe a bit more concentrated geographically. It covers over 15 million homes currently, but they're definitely not standing still. They're expanding too, aiming to add something like 650,000 new passings in 2025 alone. But the really big move for Verizon is their pending acquisition of Frontier Communications.
Frontier, right, another big fiber player.
Exactly. That deal is set to add roughly 9-10 million fiber passings to Verizon's reach almost overnight, a huge expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And probably more importantly, it's expected to boost their combined build rate to 1 million or more passings per year, their combined goal. Over 30 million passings by 2028, and maybe even 35 to 40 million long term. It's a massive statement of intent.
So it sounds like the big guys are getting bigger. Is it just the national giants, though? Or are there smaller regional players making waves, too?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing a real resurgence of regional players, often with very focused and efficient build strategies. Frontier itself, even before the Verizon deal, had a goal of 10 million locations by the end of 2025. They crossed 8 million back in Q1 2025. And their build costs are apparently quite competitive, maybe $1,000 to $1,100 per passing in many areas. That shows efficiency. Then you've got companies like Greenlight Networks, say in New York, or Alta Fiber in the Midwest. They're pouring millions into expanding their own fiber networks in specific cities and regions. So while the national players cover the map broadly, these regional guys are creating really intense competition block by block, making it tough for the cable incumbents locally.
So with all this fiber rolling out so fast, how does it actually change things for us, the consumers? Is it just more choice or something deeper?
It's definitely creating what analysts call market bifurcation, basically splitting the market in two.
Mm-hmm.
Fiber providers are successfully positioning themselves as the premium tier, the luxury option for internet.
Because of those symmetrical speeds and reliability.
Exactly. The symmetrical speeds, the reliability, the lower latency. They're targeting and winning the most profitable customers. Households with lots of demanding users, those crucial work-from-home folks who need the best. You even see Verizon Fios advertising their 1 gig plan with upload speeds up to 23x faster than cable. That's a direct shot.
Yeah, that's pretty explicit.
It absolutely is. And it forces cable's HFC networks, even with their latest DOCSIS 4.0 upgrades, which boost download speeds but still lag on uploads, it forces them into being perceived as tier two.
So cable becomes the good option while fiber is the best?
Kind of, yeah. Especially because of that upload speed limitation. So if fiber comes to your neighborhood, suddenly your cable service might feel less premium. That really hurts their ability to charge top dollar and keep those high-value customers.
And the overall scale of this, you mentioned a projection.
Right. New Street Research projects the total U.S. fiber footprint could hit something like 139 million locations by 2030. What that really means is fiber could be available across roughly 84% of the areas where cable currently operates. That's basically a near total overbuild.
Wow. Near total.
That's a seismic shift. What used to be a comfortable monopoly or duopoly for cable is turning into a fierce battleground pretty much everywhere.
Okay, that's a really clear picture of the high-end threat, fiber taking the power users. But you mentioned a pincer movement. What about the other side? The more value-conscious customer, maybe someone who just needs good enough internet at a better price.
That's exactly where fixed wireless access, or FWA, comes roaring in. It's a truly disruptive attack from the value end. FWA basically uses existing 5G cellular networks to beam internet into your home. It's simple, convenient, and crucially, priced very aggressively.
So it's like using your phone's hotspot, but for your whole house.
Sort of, but designed specifically for home use, often with dedicated equipment. It might not always match fiber's top speeds, but it's proving incredibly effective at grabbing customers, especially those sensitive to price or just wanting an easy setup.
How much growth are we seeing with FWA? Is it really making a dent, or is it still pretty niche?
Oh, the growth has been explosive. And what's fascinating is how directly it lines up with cable starting to see its broadband subscriber numbers flatten out and then actually decline. T-Mobile has really emerged as the leader here. In Q2 2025 alone, they added something like 454,000 5G broadband customers.
In one quarter.
One quarter. Bringing their total to 7.3 million. They're aiming for 12 million by 2028. Verizon's also seeing huge success. They actually hit their initial FWA target 15 months early, showing how much demand there was. Now they're targeting 8 to 9 million by 2028. In Q2 2024, Verizon added 378,000 fixed wireless customers. That was their eighth straight quarter, adding over 375,000 broadband customers overall, largely driven by FWA. It's definitely not niche anymore. It's mainstream.
Wow. So if FWA is growing that fast, what's happening on the cable side? What are Comcast and Charter seeing in their numbers?
The impact is stark. Both Comcast and Charter companies used to steady broadband growth year after year. They both reported their first ever quarters of flat or even negative internet subscriber growth right around the time FWA really took off nationally.
Really? First time ever?
First time ever. Comcast lost, I think, 65,000 broadband customers in Q1 24, and that loss grew to 199,000 in Q1 25. Charter saw big losses too, 177,000 in Q4 24, another 117,000 in Q2 25.
Ouch.
It's clear, FWA is directly contributing to cable's pain. Comcast President Mike Cavanaugh even said it very plainly. We are not winning in the marketplace.
That's a pretty blunt admission from a top exec.
It really is. It shows just how intense this pressure from FWA is. It proves that good enough internet, deployed simply and priced right, is a powerful weapon, and it's pulling away cable's more price-sensitive customers.
So why is FWA hitting home so effectively? Is it purely the price, or is there something else cable is missing?
Price is definitely a major weapon, no doubt, but it's not the only thing. Interestingly, a 2025 study found pretty high satisfaction rates for FWA customers. Like 76% happy with speed, 83% with reliability. That's comparable to traditional services.
So it's not just seen as a cheap, unreliable option.
Apparently not. It seems to appeal across different income levels because it's convenient, easy to set up. But the real killer app is the converged bundle. The wireless carriers can offer FWA for maybe $35 to $50 a month, often with price guarantees for a couple of years, if you also get your mobile service from them.
Ah, the bundle discount.
Exactly. It creates this incredibly strong incentive to switch both your internet and your mobile away from cable. Compare that FWA price to, say, Charter's standard rate for 300 MLOPs, which could be $85 a month standalone. That difference forces cable into using cheap discounts just to compete.
Which costs them more to acquire customers, right?
Right. Higher acquisition costs, plus you get this cliff when the promo ends and the price jumps, making customers more likely to shop around again.
So how are the cable guys fighting back against this bundling threat? Are they trying to bundle too?
They are. That's the mobile gambit we touched on. They're aggressively pushing their own mobile phone services. It's primarily a defensive move, trying to make their broadband customers stickier, less likely to leave, by adding a mobile line.
But they don't own the mobile networks, right? They're MVNOs.
Correct. They operate as mobile virtual network operators, mostly using Verizon's and T-Mobile's networks. They're essentially renting access from their main competitors. Despite that, they've seen impressive subscriber growth. Comcast added, 323,000 wireless lines in Q1 25. Charter added a huge 500,000 in Q2 25.
So if they're renting the network, it's really more about keeping the broadband customer than making big profits on mobile itself. Is that financially sustainable?
That's the crux of it. It is proving effective at reducing churn, and mobile service revenue is growing nicely for them. Charter's was up almost 25% year over year in Q2 25, but the profit margins on these MVNO services are notoriously thin. So while the subscriber numbers look good, it's growing from a small base, and it's just not enough profit to fully replace what they're losing from video and the slowing growth in core broadband.
Right. It comes back to that owner's economics idea you mentioned.
Exactly. The integrated carriers like AT&T or Verizon own both the fixed line, fiber, and the wireless networks. They capture the full value. AT&T says something like 40% of their new fiber customers also take their wireless. They can price synergistically, integrate products deeply, maximize profit across the board. Cable, as an MVNO, is always paying a wholesale fee back to their competitor. It's a fundamental long-term structural disadvantage.
Okay, so it's not just the big fiber and wireless companies cable needs to worry about. You're saying the competitive landscape is shifting in other ways too, more subtle pressures.
Yeah, if we zoom out a bit, you see policy and local initiatives also reshaping things, creating new, sometimes unexpected competition. These are those emerging threats.
Like municipal broadband, you hear about towns building their own network sometimes. How significant is that really? Is it just a few isolated cases?
It's actually a growing movement. Municipal broadband internet services built and run by local governments is expanding quite a bit. There are over 447 public networks now, way up from maybe 130 back in 2011.
Wow, that's a big jump.
It is. And it's often helped by state laws and public funding, recognizing broadband as essential, like roads or water. States like New York, California, Maine are actively supporting these efforts. Chattanooga's EPB Fiber in Tennessee is probably the most famous example. A really successful city-run gigabit service that's been around for years and forced incumbents to up their game. These muni networks create permanent, often government-backed competitors that might prioritize access and affordability over maximizing profits, which can be really hard for private companies to compete against directly.
Interesting. What about satellite internet, like Starlink? I always thought that was just for super rural places where nothing else worked. Has that changed?
Historically, yes. It was a niche solution for the truly unserved. but Starlink and potentially others like Amazon's Project Kuiper down the line, their relevance has been boosted significantly by a key policy change. Specifically, the rewrite of the rules for the big $42.45 billion BEAD program back in June 2025.
BEAD, right. That's the big federal program to get internet everywhere.
Exactly. Broadband equity, access, and deployment. Set up by the 2021 Infrastructure Act to connect unserved and underserved areas, mostly rural. Initially, the BEAD rules strongly preferred fiber projects, seeing fiber as the best long-term investment.
Okay, so what was the wild card? How did that policy shift change things for cable?
The wild card was when the Commerce Department, in June 25, basically dropped that fiber-first preference. They shifted to a model that's technology-neutral and prioritizes the lowest-cost-per-location solution.
Ah, lowest cost. That sounds like it would favor wireless or satellite over expensive fiber builds in rural areas.
Massively. It's a huge advantage for FWA and LEO satellite providers because digging fiber trenches in the middle of nowhere is incredibly expensive. Remember that Tennessee BEAD funding round example? The average bid from LEO satellite providers was just $228,000 per location. Fiber providers were asking for an average of $2.7 million for similar areas.
That's a gigantic difference.
It's astronomical. So now, government policy through BEAD can end up subsidizing cable's direct competitors, FWA, and satellite in these rural markets. It flips BEAD from being a potential source of funds for cable to expand into a mechanism that helps rivals build out and lock down those markets, potentially for decades. It completely changes the game in rural America.
So, looking at the whole competitive picture, it's not the same everywhere, right? It varies depending on where you live.
Absolutely. You can think of it like a competitive heat map. The intensity varies a lot. Fiber overbuilds, super intense and dense suburbs, affluent second-tier cities, you might have multiple companies fighting for your business there. FWA availability, really strong in big cities and many suburbs where the 5G networks are already built out. Municipal networks, growing in smaller cities and certain rural areas where maybe the private sector wasn't investing enough. So for you, the listener, your options and how hard companies compete for you really depends on your specific location. If you're in a hot zone, you might get better deals and more choices.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting, maybe even a bit worrying for the cable companies. All this competition, it's not just about who has the most subscribers, it's hitting their finances, right? Let's start with what used to be their absolute cash cow, traditional TV, linear video. That bundle seems to be unraveling fast.
It really is. The decline of traditional pay TV is just relentless, like a slow motion avalanche, as you said. This unraveling bundle is a profound financial headache for them. It systematically pulls apart the business model that made them so profitable for so long. People migrating from cable boxes to streaming. It's just accelerating. Projections showed that the number of U.S. households without pay TV, that's cord cutters plus cord nevers, actually overtook the number with pay TV back in 2024.
Overtook them already. Wow.
Yeah. And the gap is widening fast. Forecasts suggest maybe 81 million non-pay TV homes by 2026, compared to only 54 million still holding onto a traditional subscription. Just think, back in 2010, it was 105 million pay TV households. It's a massive, irreversible shift in consumer behavior.
What's the actual dollar impact of that shift? Losing all those TV customers must hurt the bottom line significantly.
Oh, it's severe. Industry-wide, estimates put the lost pay TV revenue at something like $10.5 billion just between 2020 and 2025. You see it in their quarterly results constantly. Comcast lost almost 500,000 video customers in Q1 24. Charter lost 123,000 in Q4 24, another 80,000 in Q2 25. Charter's Q2 2025 video revenue down almost 10% compared to the year before.
And why are people leaving in such droves? Is it just cheaper streaming options?
Price is the big one. Something like 87% of cord cutters point to the high price of cable as the main reason. But it's also the convenience of streaming, right? On demand, often ad-free. People just prefer it. For you, the listener, it's clear, why pay for hundreds of channels you don't watch when you can pick and choose cheaper streaming apps?
Yeah, that resonates. But it's not just fewer people paying, is it? What about the cost of the channels themselves, especially sports? Isn't that going up?
That's the other hammer blow. Programming costs, especially for live sports, are experiencing hyperinflation. Total U.S. media rights for sports. Projected to jump from around $25, $26 billion in 2023 to over $30 billion by 2025.
$30 billion just for sports rights.
Yep. And it's being fueled by new players. Amazon, Apple bidding aggressively for premium sports packages to draw people to their own streaming platforms. This drives the prices up to unprecedented levels, as analysts say. It also fragments where you can watch games. So cable companies like Comcast and Charter are forced to pay way more for content that's becoming less exclusive, squeezing their already thin video margins even further. It's a bidding war they can't really win.
So it sounds like this truly vicious cycle. Can you explain that negative flywheel concept again? How does that trap them?
Absolutely. It's a destructive feedback loop. As customers cut the cord, those massive fixed costs, especially those ballooning sports rights contracts, have to be spread across fewer and fewer remaining subscribers.
Right. So everyone left has to pay more.
Exactly. To try and protect their margins, the cable operators have to push through price hikes, often significant ones, on their remaining video customers. But those price hikes just make the traditional bundle look even worse compared to cheaper, more flexible streaming options.
Which makes even more people cut the cord.
Precisely. It accelerates the whole process, and the rising cost of sports just pours gasoline on that fire. So video goes from being a core profit engine to, at best, maybe a low-margin tool to keep broadband customers from leaving. At worst, it's a money loser they're stuck with. It's a downward spiral.
Okay, so with video basically collapsing as a profit center, cable is leaning super hard on broadband now. But is that a safe bet? Is ARPU, average revenue per user for broadband, holding up against all this competition?
That's the critical question, isn't it? Can broadband alone carry the weight? And the answer is, it's getting really tough. Their ability to command high prices, high ARPU for broadband, is severely constrained now. The core issue is they've lost their pricing power. For years, broadband felt like a monopoly in many places. Demand was inelastic. People paid what they had to. They could raise prices pretty regularly.
Right, you just kind of expected your bill to go up every year.
Exactly. But now, with real scaled competitors, fiber offering premium speeds, FWA offering great value that's broken, the market suddenly has significant price elasticity. Consumers have options, and they will switch if the price is right.
How specifically are fiber and FWA putting the screws on broadband pricing?
Okay, so at the low end, FWA acts as a really strong price anchor, T-Mobile, Verizon. They're offering service for as low as $35-$50 a month, especially with mobile bundles, often with price locks. That makes cable standard pricing, like Charter's $85 for 300 Mbps standalone, look really expensive. It forces cable into those deep introductory promo prices we talked about. Mm-hmm. That hurts profitability per customer initially and creates that churn risk later.
And at the high end, how does fiber cap their pricing?
At the high end, fiber overbuilders limit how much cable can charge for their fastest speeds. As fiber becomes available, it sets a new standard for quality and value, especially with those symmetrical speeds. It makes cable's gigabit plans, which are still asymmetrical, look less appealing. Why pay top dollar for cable gigabit if you can get symmetrical fiber gigabit for the same price or less?
Makes sense. So ARPU growth must be slowing down then.
It is. We saw Charter's residential revenue per customer grew just 1.7% year over year in Q4 2024. That's pretty slow. S&P Global Projects cable ARPU will still grow a bit in 2025, but they specifically note it relies on price increases that are getting harder and harder to push through without losing more customers. So for you, the consumer, yeah, you might see more aggressive promo deals from cable, but you might also realize their top plans aren't the best value anymore if fiber is an option.
And if a broadband-only customer brings in less profit overall than the old bundle customer, does that change the fundamental profitability of their business, even if ARPU looks okay?
It absolutely does. A broadband-only customer is just inherently less profitable than someone who used to pay for video and maybe phone too. Losing that video bundle means losing a second high-margin product they used to use to basically subsidize everything else. That puts unavoidable downward pressure on how much profit they make per household and on their overall corporate margins.
So even if they bundle broadband with that low-margin mobile service to make the ARPU number look higher,
exactly. They might get, say, $60 for broadband plus $20 for mobile for an $80 ARPU. That looks better than maybe a $70 broadband-only ARPU from before. But the profit from that $80 bundle is likely lower because the margin on the MVNO mobile part is tiny. So just looking at ARPU can be misleading if the underlying profitability per customer has gone down.
Okay, so video is declining, broadband ARPU is pressured. What's cable's big strategic move to try and prop up the business model? What are they betting on now?
The big pivot is aggressively promoting their mobile offerings. That mobile gambit we discussed, it's really a defensive necessity now, almost a lifeline. The main goal is to make customers stickier, reduce that broadband churn by getting them to bundle mobile.
Using the MVNO model, renting network access.
Right, primarily using Verizon and T-Mobile's networks. And the subscriber growth has been impressive, as we said. Comcast adding over 300,000 lines in a quarter, Charter adding 500,000. They're basically saying, okay, you might leave our TV service, but please stay for internet and maybe take our mobile plan too.
So it really is about holding on to that core broadband customer, not about mobile being some huge new profit engine. How does that play out long term, essentially paying your competitors to help retain your own customers?
Precisely. It's effective at reducing churn. And the mobile revenue looks good on paper. Charter's up 25% year over year recently. But again, those MVNO margins are slim. The growth is from a small base, and the profit just isn't enough to fully replace the erosion from video and the slowing broadband growth. It comes back to that owner's economics disadvantage. They're paying competitors for network access. For you, the listener, it might mean attractive mobile deals from your cable company, but understand it's not a sign they've found a massive new profit source. It's defense.
Okay, so facing all this competition, all this financial pressure, cable companies have to invest heavily in their networks just to keep up. And there's a huge multi-billion dollar question hanging over them. Do they go all in on fiber like AT&T and Verizon? Or do they upgrade their existing HFC networks with this DOCSIS 4.0 technology?
This is the absolute capital crucible for them. A true generational crossroads. The choice they make here, upgrade HFC with DOCSIS 4.0 or commit to a full fiber to the home build, will define their competitive position, their financial health, their relevance for the next decade or more. It's probably the biggest strategic bet they've faced in ages.
What's the argument for DOCSIS 4.0 then? Why stick with upgrading the old network when fiber seems like the superior future-proof technology?
The main reason, it boils down to one thing, capital efficiency, money. It's all about leveraging the billions they've already invested in their existing HFC plant to deliver multi-gigabit download speeds at a tiny fraction of the cost of building fiber everywhere from scratch.
How big is the cost difference, really?
It's stark. Almost hard to believe. Comcast says upgrading to DOCSIS 4.0 costs them under $200 per home passed. Charter is targeting just $100 per home. Now compare that to building brand new FTTH networks. That can range from $500 to maybe $1,400 per home in typical areas. And in really tough rural spots, it can hit $7,000 per home or even more.
Wow. Okay. $100, $200 versus potentially thousands. That's huge.
It's massive. So DOCSIS 4.0 lets them deploy faster, get multi-gig download speeds out there sooner. Charter, for instance, aims to offer 5 GBPs down and 1 GBPs up to 85% of their footprint by the end of 2025. It's about getting good enough speeds to most people, much faster and much, much cheaper.
But there has to be a catch, right? What's the downside? What's the argument against DOCSIS 4.0, especially when everyone else seems to be racing towards fiber?
You're right, there are significant risks. This is the core to the bear case against cable. While DOCSIS 4.0 is a big improvement, it's still fundamentally asymmetrical. Download speeds can be great, yes, but upload speeds max out technically around 6 GBPs, but are more realistically 1 to 5 GBPs in actual deployments. Yeah. That still lags fiber's true symmetrical speeds, where upload matches download. Fiber also has better latency, less lag, and is considered genuinely future-proof because the upgrade potential on fiber is almost limitless.
Whereas DOCSIS 4.0 is kind of the end of the line for HFC.
Pretty much. It's widely seen as the last major upgrade for that architecture. There isn't a clear path beyond it. So this creates a massive gamble for cable. They're betting that good enough multi-gig download speeds will keep most customers happy for the next, say, 5 to 7 years, saving billions in the process.
What's the risk if they're wrong? The stranded asset idea.
Exactly. That's the nightmare scenario. The stranded asset risk. Imagine they spend billions upgrading to DOCSIS 4.0, and then some new killer app emerges. Mainstream VRR, immersive gaming, advanced AI on home devices.
Yeah.
Something that suddenly makes high-capacity symmetrical uploads essential for everyone.
Uh-oh.
If that happens, DOCSIS 4.0 could become obsolete much faster than they planned. They'd have spent billions on what turned out to be just a temporary fix, a bridge to nowhere, and then they'd be forced into doing that hugely expensive full fiber overbuild anyway, but from a much weaker financial and competitive position. That's the central long-term fear for the cable industry. It's a bet on how fast our digital needs will evolve.
So my internet connection in 5 or 10 years really depends on how this gamble plays out for them.
In many ways, yes. It's a critical decision point.
And just when they're wrestling with these huge existential investment choices, the government throws in that BEAD program wildcard you mentioned earlier. That shifts the landscape again.
Exactly. The BEAD program, that big pot of federal money for rural broadband, was initially seen as maybe a positive catalyst, a source of funds to help build out. But that policy shift, dropping the fiber preference, has dramatically changed the equation for rural areas, potentially turning BEAD into another competitive threat against cable.
Remind me how that worked again.
Sure. The $42.5 billion BEAD program from the 2021 Infrastructure Act was meant to connect unserved areas. Initially, it prioritized funding fiber projects, seeing them as the best long-term solution. That might have helped cable companies like Charter with their own rural expansion plans.
But then the rules changed.
Right. In June 25, the Commerce Department guidance shifted to technology-neutral, lowest cost per location,
which favors FWA and satellite in expensive-to-build rural areas.
Hugely favors them. Remember the Tennessee example. $228,000 average bid for satellite versus $2.7 million for fiber in similar areas. So BEAD now effectively subsidizes cable's competitors in these markets. It locks cable out of getting those funds in many states and helps rivals build networks there instead. It's a complete reversal of how that money might have flowed initially.
Okay, so pulling all this together, the competition, the tech dilemmas, the policy shifts, how are Comcast and Charter actually holding up financially through all this? What do their balance sheets look like?
Right, this is where we look at their financial fortitude. How resilient are they? Both companies carry significant debt, which isn't unusual for this industry, but their ability to manage that debt in this tough environment. Well, we see slightly different risk profiles emerging.
Let's start with Comcast. How leveraged are they? Is their debt manageable?
Comcast, as of Q1 2025, had about $99 billion in total debt against $87 billion in equity. That's a debt-to-equity ratio of around 113%, so slightly more debt than equity. But the key metric analysts watch is their net leverage ratio, net debt divided by adjusted EBITDA. For Comcast, that was a pretty manageable 2.3x at the end of Q1 25. Generally seen as healthy for a company their size. They also have solid investment-grade credit ratings, ALA3 stable, meaning lenders see them as low risk and they can borrow relatively cheaply.
Okay, so Comcast seems relatively solid financially. What about Charter? Are they playing it safer or riskier with debt?
Charter has definitely employed a more aggressive leverage strategy. Their total debt was similar, around $95 billion as of March 2025. But relative to their earnings, their debt burden is much higher. Their debt-to-EBITDA ratio was around 4.1x in Q1 2025.
4.1x, that's nearly double Comcast's 2.3x.
It is. It means they need much stronger earnings performance just to keep that leverage stable. They have less wiggle room if things go wrong. And that's reflected in their credit ratings, which are below investment grade, BB plus Bay1 stable. Their own public filings even list their significant amount of debt as a key risk factor that could limit their flexibility. Higher leverage means higher risk, especially when facing headwinds.
You mentioned a leverage trap. What exactly is that, and why is it such a worry now, especially with growth slowing?
This is a critical risk in the current climate. The leverage trap happens when slowing profit growth meets a large, fixed pile of debt. Think about it. Historically, cable grew earnings steadily, so even with debt, their leverage ratios stayed okay or even improved. But now, competition is hitting subscribers and pricing. EBITDA growth has slowed dramatically. Comcast was flat year over year in Q1 24. Charter grew just 0.5% in Q2 25.
So if earnings EBITDA flatten or fall,
then the leverage ratio, debt EBITDA, automatically goes up, even if they don't borrow more money, because the denominator is shrinking.
And that triggers problems.
It can. Rising leverage can lead to credit rating downgrades, making future borrowing much more expensive. It could even risk violating debt covenants promises made to lenders. That severely ties management's hands. It forces brutal choices, cut back on crucial network investments, falling further behind, or cut shareholder returns like dividends or buybacks, upsetting investors. The balance sheet becomes a major constraint.
What about free cash flow then? The actual cash left over after everything, that's the real lifeblood, right? How are they managing that while funding investments and satisfying shareholders?
Free cash flow, FCF, is the ultimate bottom line, yes. And it's truly at a crossroads for these companies. Looking at FCF really highlights their different approaches to spending that cash, their divergent capital allocation philosophies.
Okay, let's look at Comcast again first. Are they still churning out a lot of cash? What are they doing with it?
Comcast remains a cash-generating machine. They reported $4.5 billion in FCF in Q1 24 and an even better $5.4 billion in Q1 25. For the full year 2024, it was over $15 billion. And their strategy for using that cash seems pretty clear and balanced. Priority one, invest in growth areas, broadband, wireless, business services, theme parks like the new Epic Universe, Peacock streaming. Priority two, maintain a strong balance sheet. Priority three, returned significant cash to shareholders.
How much are they returning?
In Q1 25 alone, they returned $3.2 billion and $1.2 billion in dividends, $2.0 billion in share buybacks, and they have this impressive 17-year streak of increasing their dividend. That signals a commitment to sustainable returns.
So a balanced approach from Comcast. What about Charter? Similar story with free cash flow.
Charter's FCF picture has been a bit more volatile, and it's showing signs of pressure, even decline recently. In Q2 2025, their FCF was $1.0 billion, down from $1.3 billion the year before. They pointed to things like mobile working capital timing, higher cash taxes, but also significantly higher capital spending on their rural build-out and network upgrades.
But are they still returning cash to shareholders?
Oh, yes. Despite the FCF pressure, they remained heavily committed to share buybacks, repurchasing $1.7 billion of stock in that same quarter. Their focus is clearly on evolving the network, the rural build, and converged services, funded partly by FCF and partly by debt, while aggressively buying back stock.
It sounds like a fundamental conflict brewing, though. They need to spend billions on networks to compete, but they're also committed to these huge shareholder returns, all while the core business is under attack. Can they keep doing both?
That's the inevitable squeeze. Yeah. There's tremendous tension between funding these multi-billion-dollar investments, Comcast's theme park and streaming, Charter's massive rural fiber build, while also promising huge returns to Wall Street. And it's happening just as residential connectivity faces unprecedented competition and video collapses. So the long-term sustainability of current FCF levels, and therefore the current pace of shareholder returns, is genuinely questionable for the industry.
What are the bull and bear arguments there?
The bear case is simple. FCF will decline as competition bites deeper. Management will be forced into painful choices, cut dividends buybacks, angering investors, or underinvest in the network, ceding the future to rivals. The bull case hopes that new growth areas, mobile, business services, maybe theme parks for Comcast, ramp up fast enough to generate enough new cash flow to offset the decay in the traditional business.
And this highlights their different philosophies again.
Absolutely. It's critical for investors. Comcast is the dividend grower, balanced, disciplined, probably more sustainable if growth slows. Charter's the buyback machine, no dividend, uses all FCF and even debt to buy back stock aggressively. But that strategy, using leverage for buybacks, is really ill-suited for a business potentially facing contraction. It amplifies the downside risk massively. If FCF keeps falling, Charter faces a brutal choice. Slash the buybacks that underpin their stock story, or pile on even more debt onto an already leveraged balance sheet.
Okay, beyond the market battles and the financial pressures, what about regulation? How does government policy factor into this high-stakes game? Is it just setting rules or actively influencing outcomes?
The regulatory landscape is definitely chessboard, constantly shifting. We saw that big swing at the federal level on net neutrality, which then got complicated by state rules.
Right, the federal reversal. Can you quickly recap what happened there?
Sure. In January 2025, a federal appeals court struck down the FCC's 2024 order that tried to bring back net neutrality rules by reclassifying broadband under Title II, like a utility. The court said the FCC overstepped its authority. This is a significant ruling, one of the first big tests of the Supreme Court's Loper-Bright decision limiting agency power. So, on paper, a win for ISPs who generally fight Title II regulation.
So no federal net neutrality means easier sailing for ISPs, right?
Not necessarily. It might be a Pyrrhic victory, winning the battle, but maybe losing the war. Because killing the federal rule doesn't kill the state rules. It actually replaces one predictable federal standard with this messy, balkanized patchwork of different rules across different states.
So states like California still have their own net neutrality laws.
Exactly. California, Washington, Oregon. They have robust state laws mirroring the old federal rules. No blocking, no throttling, no paid prioritization. New York has rules for state contractors. For national ISPs like Comcast and Charter, this patchwork means higher compliance costs and more operational complexity trying to navigate different regulations state by state. It makes operating a national network harder, not easier.
What about other regulatory fronts, like antitrust or those local muni networks we talked about?
Good question. Consolidation is one area to watch. With valuations pressured, could we see more M&A, like the rumored Charter Cox deal? How regulators view such deals will be a key signal for the industry, though integrating different customer bases and pricing always carries risks. And then there's that ongoing battle over preemption laws, the state laws that block or limit cities from building their own broadband networks. At least 16 states have these laws, heavily pushed by incumbents. But the tide might be turning slightly. The pandemic highlighted broadband gaps, and with federal BEAD money available, some states are looking at repealing or weakening these laws. That could open the door for more municipal competition down the road. So the policy chessboard is definitely still in play.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground-intense competition, financial strain, huge investment decisions, shifting regulations, so synthesizing all of that. What does it actually mean for the future? How fast will these changes hit? And what are the real possible outcomes for companies like Comcast and Charter?
Right. By pulling all these threads together, we can try to build a framework for what might happen next, outline a likely timeline, and sketch out some potential investment outcome scenarios. Try to give you a sense of the road ahead.
Let's start with that timeline. What does the immediate future look like? Are we talking peak crisis mode right now, or is it more gradual?
The short term, say the next year or two, 2025 into 2026, looks like peak pain.
Yeah.
This is likely when competitive intensity will be highest. Fiber builders aggressively marketing new areas, FWA providers continuing their rapid growth, will probably see continued, maybe even accelerating, broadband subscriber losses for cable. Some analysts are bracing for negative net adds for maybe the next 4 years.
4 years of losses.
It's possible. During this time, the full impact of those revised BEAD rules favoring FWA satellite in rural areas will become clear, closing off expansion routes for cable. And internally, they'll be deep in the disruption of their DOCSS 4.0 upgrades, spending money, focusing operations, but not seeing immediate major benefits yet. The result. Intense pressure on margins, intense scrutiny on every dollar of free cash flow. It's going to be tough.
What about the medium term? Say 3 to 5 years out, 2027 to 2029. Does it settle down or does the market split permanently? The medium term, maybe 2027, 2029, we're calling stabilization or stratification. By then, things might start finding a new normal, but it won't be the old normal. FWA growth might level off as carriers hit capacity limits in denser areas. Most of the big announced fiber builds should be largely finished, so we'll have a clearer picture of market share. Any big M&A deals like Verizon Frontier would be integrated. The key question then becomes, does the market stabilize into some kind of balance between the players, or does it become permanently stratified? You know, fiber owns premium, FWA owns value, and cable is stuck fighting for the middle ground.
And the end game. Looking even further out, 5-10 years, 2030, 2035. What's the final verdict?
The long term, 2030, 2035, that's the end game. This is when we'll know for sure if cable's big DOCSS 4.0 bet paid off. Was it a smart, capital-efficient bridge that kept them competitive? Or was it just a costly delay before an inevitable, painful fiber rebuild? The market will render its verdict. We'll also see the role of newer technologies more clearly, maybe 6G wireless, maybe advanced satellites like Amazon's Kuiper introducing new disruptions. The outcomes for cable could range from successfully transforming into stable utility-like companies providing essential connectivity, all the way to a managed decline as legacy providers.
That's a huge range from stable utility to managed decline. Can you break down those investment scenarios you mentioned? What are the odds for each path?
Sure. Our base case, the most likely outcome, maybe a 50% probability, is the muddle through. In this scenario, cable pulls off the DOCSS 4.0 upgrade. It proves good enough for most people. It slows the subscriber losses, but doesn't stop them entirely. They stabilize with a decent defensible market share, maybe 40-50%. Their mobile bundles and business services grow enough to partly offset the declines elsewhere. Free cash flow comes down from the peaks, but stays positive, allowing them to keep returning some cash to shareholders, maybe just less than before. Valuations adjust lower to reflect slower growth, but they find a floor as utility-like stocks.
Okay, so muddling through is the base case. What are the downside? That stranded asset scenario sounds pretty bad.
The bear case, maybe a 35% probability, is indeed the stranded asset. Here, FWA and fiber competition is even fiercer than expected. Cable sees sustained, maybe mid-single-digit annual broadband losses. Price wars erupt. And crucially, DOCSS 4.0 is perceived as insufficient. Maybe that killer app needing symmetrical bandwidth really takes off. The DOCSS investment becomes a huge write-off, a stranded asset.
Forcing them to build fiber anyway.
Forcing them into an unplanned, full-cost fiber build, but from a position of financial weakness. FCF could turn negative, dividends buybacks suspended, credit downgrades triggered. It could even lead to forced asset sales, breakups, or debt restructuring, especially for a company like Charter with this higher leverage. It's a grim outcome.
And the flip side, the most optimistic view, converged utility champion sounds like a total turnaround.
The bull case, maybe a lower 15% probability, is the converged utility champion. In this scenario, FWA turns out to be more niche, maybe hitting capacity walls sooner. DOCSIS 4.0 is widely accepted as perfectly fine. Most people don't need or won't pay for symmetrical fiber speeds. Cable's mobile bundle works brilliantly, locking in customers and slashing churn. Maybe competitors' fiber builds slow down due to costs or labor issues. Cable manages to keep some pricing power, margins stabilize, FCF holds up or even grows, justifying a better valuation. They successfully become converged champions.
So, looking across this whole ecosystem, with all these potential shifts, who are the likely winners and losers in this big industry transformation?
The winners seem pretty clear. First, the direct competitors, the disruptors. Fiber providers like AT&T, Verizon, Frontier are set to gain high-value customers. Second, the wireless carriers, especially T-Mobile. They win from their own FWA growth and from the MVNO revenue they get from cable renting their networks. Double-dipping, almost. And don't forget the picks and shovels companies, the ones making the equipment, the fiber optic cable, the engineering firms doing the builds, they'll see high demand for years.
And the losers?
Well, the incumbent cable operators like Comcast and Charter are clearly facing the biggest challenges. Their cash cow video business is in terminal decline. Their core broadband business, once protected, is under unprecedented attack from both the high end and the low end. They're caught in that pincer movement. Their future seems less about growth and more about defending their position, managing mature assets, and navigating this incredibly complex transition.
So, as you, our listener, think about your own internet service, maybe as you stream this deep dive instead of watching cable, consider this. What new innovation or unexpected policy shift might be next? What could rewrite the rules of connectivity all over again? And how might your own needs change? Will symmetrical speeds become essential for things we haven't even dreamed up yet? Will new ways to get online emerge? Keep an eye on what your provider is offering. Keep an eye out for those new names maybe popping up in your neighborhood. The future of your internet connection might be changing faster than you realize.